Well, while the slide is loading, I want to just make two sort of off-the-cuff comments. One is the advantage of going last is you can pull some things from the previous speakers and feed on them a little bit. And I just want to thank them, because I learned from Don that I have to learn GLM mixed. This is important. But also, as we're setting up some new experiments that I'll just talk briefly about, this advantage of staggering starts, because I think that's a very important point, particularly as we think more about perennials and biofuels. It's going to be very important to have that. I want to thank Bob for pointing out the value of having some prior data before you set up a long-term experiment. And I'll point out that people did that, and we did some blocking, but that still is a very important factor. And then from Steve, to recognize that 20 years is not long enough. And as you'll see, the project I'll be talking about is perhaps the youngest of these long-term experiments. I also want to just quickly acknowledge some of the things that Roger Beachy said this morning, his comments. First of all, to assure you that the ag experiment stations and extension are still viable at Michigan State University. The governor did not veto us from her budget. But it perhaps speaks to my role as an administrator that I think that a 44% budget reduction is a good thing compared to that. But this year, that is being backfilled with stimulus money, and we are not sure what will happen in the future. But we do have extension and ag experiment station as of Friday, still at Michigan State University. I was a little challenged to see why I was asked to give this talk, and I found out that apparently KBS made the calendar, and so we were acknowledged as a calendar site. But also in sort of for full disclosure, I'm giving this talk under an administrator's perspective, but the project I'll be talking about, I have been involved with as a scientist since its inception in just the last 4 or 5 years in the role of administrator. So whether that reflects my biases or my perspective, I'm not sure which. So first of all, let me just say a little bit what I want to talk about. The focus of my talk is going to be on the long-term ecological research project at the Kellogg Biological Station. And it is unique from many of the projects you've heard about, but perhaps more like some of the things that were called for this morning, is that this has been part of a long-term ecological research network that has been funded by the National Science Foundation for some time. So I want to tell you a little bit about that network and what that means to be part of a network. I know there's been discussion within USDA of forming a long-term research in agricultural systems as well, and I think you'll see some of the advantages of that from this talk. Then I want to just tell you a little bit about the KBS LTR project itself, how it has grown and expanded over the last 20, 22 years, and then tell you some of the benefits and obligations of a long-term research project in agriculture from an administrator's perspective. So first of all, what is LTER? LTER is a network of research sites across North America, and in fact, there's an international component to this at all. Also, there's an international LTER. There are currently 26 sites throughout the United States. These are all funded by the National Science Foundation. They are in a variety of ecosystem types. There are alpine systems. There are Arctic systems. There are Antarctic systems. There are two urban systems, and so there are wild systems. Several of the LTRs do focus on production systems. For example, the shortgrass steppe here in Colorado is a grazing land system. There are forested systems at Andrews and down in Coweta. The KBS site is the other one, only one, however, that's looking at production agriculture in the sense of row crops, specifically. Now, what keeps all of these sites coherent and allows us to think of ourselves as a network is that at the inception, the National Science Foundation and others decreed, if you will, that there would be 5 core research topics or themes or questions that all of these sites would focus on. Now, individual sites take different approaches to them, obviously, but there are 5 core research themes or areas that all of us have to memorize as we sign in so we can say what they are, or you can just grab them off the website, as I did. But one of these is that all of the sites look at patterns and controls of primary productivity. In the agricultural system, that could be yield. In Kansa, that may be above-ground biomass. In forestry, it might be wood production. But there is this basic goal of trying to understand patterns and controls of primary production. All the sites also spend time and effort, it varies among the sites, on the spatial and temporal distribution of populations selected to represent trophic structure. Patterns and controls of organic matter, accumulation in surface layers. This has become incredibly important as we spend more and more time thinking now about carbon sequestration, and the long-term data sets are there to begin to evaluate that. Patterns of inorganic inputs and movements of nutrients through soils, groundwater, and surface waters, that's very different in Baltimore than in Phoenix than in the Arctic or the Antarctic. But all of the sites are focusing on that question. And then patterns and frequency of site disturbances. Again, is it fire? Is it hurricane? Is it human effects? But all of the sites are affecting on that. So obviously, primary control, primary production is a very different variable and a very different factor when you're in northern boreal forests or in lakes in Wisconsin than you are in a cropping system. And one of the things the LTR has focused on is coming up with both standardized methods, but also good understanding of what might be the best way to measure that factor if it's so important. And that's been a cross-site collaboration. Similarly, if you're looking at spatial and temporal distribution populations, at our site, we focus on major mesofauna like this lady beetle, whereas in Morea, they focus on clownfish. So it's a little more, perhaps, attractive sort of organism. Penguins are a major herbivore in the Antarctic and play a very important role in that system. Can we assess their impacts relative to lady beetles? No. But it means that all of these projects are focusing on a very similar set of questions, which has been very important because if you're going to function as a network, you have to have some data in common. One of the very, very strong benefits of the Long-Term Ecological Research Network, which has been a very important component here, is their sustained and continued funding. Grants are funded for 6 years at a time with the expectation of renewal. Every 3 years, there's a renewal process, either a site review or a formal proposal, and sites do not get to a free ride all the time. There have been sites that have been eliminated. But it's set up with the intent of this continued long-term funding, which is very important because it sets the scale and the scope of questions you might not otherwise answer. The expectation is it's a long-term experiment, not a 2 to 3 or 4 year experiment. There are opportunities for supplements. So that has been very important, particularly in terms of training and technology and keeping the sites equivalent and up to date as new technologies come along, particularly in data management and connectivity. To me, a very exciting aspect of this project has been the role of collaboration across the site. And I point out here a paper published in Science by Knapp and Smith in 2001. It used data from a number of sites, including data I had collected. But it put the data I had collected on basically weed biomass in these plots in comparison with lots of other sites and tried to identify and did successfully identify major drivers of productivity across these sites, which was a valuable thing. There is a focus on education and outreach. Roger Beege talked this morning about broader impacts. One of the important ways that NSF gets to express the value of its science is to show how it is contributing to K-12 education. All of the sites have a schoolyard ecology program, which is interesting, and all of them have the goal of increasing public understanding of science. Most exciting because of the network to me is bringing together these very, very good scientists to think about what is the next decade going to require of us. And so NSF has charged us to develop decadal plans more than once. And a very exciting aspect of that has recently been this ISSE, an Integrated Science for Society of the Environment, was explicitly calling for a greater focus on social sciences and integration of understanding of humans within this LTER network. There are site commitments. Everybody has to go to a committee meeting. Everybody's involved. There are workshops and meetings, and there's a strong focus on cross-site collaborations. Your renewal proposal has to explicitly say how it is your site is valuable to the network. How are you involved in that? Perhaps most importantly, and a major commitment by everyone, is this idea of data management access. There is a separate data managers group within the LTER. There are data managers at each site, and there is an explicit policy for data sharing. Data must be made available. It must be made available in a reasonable time point and on the web and freely accessible. Now, that doesn't mean every graduate student's data goes from their notebook through a quality check on the board. But the idea is there are core data in those core areas that should be available to everyone. The expectation is it's available to everyone. Sites can differ a little bit on how authorship needs to be attributed, but there's a very clear commitment to public access to the data. It is supported by the National Science Foundation. There's also a commitment to synthesis activities cross-site and within site, and each of the sites is expected to produce a synthesis volume of some sort. There are administrative commitments. An agency like NSF does not make the kind of financial commitment that it has made to these sites without some expectation on the part of the institution that the site will be there. Many of the sites are not owned by the university or the scientists that run them. They're owned by the Nature Conservancy or the U.S. Forest Service or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So there are memorandums of understanding about the fact that this project will be supported and the site will be available. In our case, it's the commitment to maintaining the experiment. There's also a commitment to sustaining leadership. These projects are not successful if the PIs are turning over constantly. And so one of the administrative commitments is to make sure that there is good leadership, which can and often does require that you think about hiring new faculty when core faculty members retire. Elder Paul, Mike Klug, and Dick Harwood, who were fundamental in the initiation of this project, have retired. And there was a commitment by the university that they would replace those faculty with other leading faculty to make sure this project continued. There's also a commitment of cost sharing, and I bring that up because we, as you'll see, we're up for renewal, and I now, in my role as administrator, will sit down with deans and directors and negotiate cost sharing again for this project. Some of what I'm telling you today will be part of that presentation. So what is a KBS LTR? It is a very unique approach to studying agricultural ecosystems. The projects we heard about earlier were plot-level studies. Different treatments were set up, and you looked at many variables, but often yield. But it was a plot-level focus, and we certainly have that, as you'll see. Species composition, nutrient processes, population dynamics are all studied at the plot level. But there's also a strong interest in landscape-level effects, because many of the organisms and elements that we study don't just stay within the plot, they move. Predators are one of them. Energy and nutrient flows, but just understanding the connectivity between landscape elements is an important component of this project as well. The experimental ecosystems represent some of the atypical kinds of systems. There are four row crop systems that vary in the kinds of inputs: conventional tillage, no-till, low input with legume covers, and what is a certifiable, if not certified, organic treatment. There are perennial plots, alfalfa and poplars. Poplars are increasingly being seen as a crop species in the Midwest, as we think about biofuels, for example. And there are early successional and mid-successional communities, some of which were established at the time of the project as checks, and others which are identified from the surrounding landscape. So the first LTER had as its focus organisms in the agricultural landscape. The initial grant was written and then funded in response to an RFP from the National Science Foundation for an LTER site in agricultural ecology. They already had other LTER sites, and they were looking to expand the range of ecosystems they were looking at. I have no idea why they chose agricultural ecology, but they did. It was funded in 1987 at $400,000 a year for 6 years. The main site experiment, which you see here, was established in 1989. In 1988, soybeans was grown across the whole plot, and a large number of variants, soil variants and plant protection variants and other variants, were measured in an attempt to come up with a way to block this experiment to account for what might be some of the underlying variation that often is true, even when you take the flattest land that you have, that has been in continuous corn production and similar management for 20 years, which the site had been. The experimental design is 7 treatments with an 8 located off-site, which is a reference. It's a randomized block design. It's replicated 6 times. And the plots are relatively large, about a hectare. And there's standard sampling protocols, where you sample, when you sample, how you sample, that are maintained across this. The little shadings you see here represent various experiments that have been set up. One of the things that we realized is it would be important to have areas where you could do shorter-term experience. So the top part of each of these plots is actually designated for what we call a microplot experiment. So people can put in shorter-term experiments there for a 2, 5, or 10-year period. But the idea is they are proposed to be a short-term experiment, not a long-term part of the experiment. So a lot of thought went into setting this up with the idea that this would be a project in place for a long time, and we needed to be both responsive to and cognizant of the need of researchers for shorter-term experiments. So it was the institutional commitment. It was 136 acres of what the farm manager called his very best land that was taken out from him and put into this experiment. And the Ag Experiment Station put up the funding as well as some startup funding for creating. And Elder Paul, who was one of the people who started this project, just walked in the room. So 6 years later, a second LTR proposal was written. This time, the people had the courage to actually admit it was a long-term research in row crop agriculture, not just organisms in the agricultural landscape. And there was a scale expansion that was a part of this project, and it was done for a couple of different reasons. One was we recognized that even though the 1-hectare plots were large, they weren't large enough. There might be some important factors, particularly relating to animal movement, dispersal of pests and pathogens that required larger plots. And so the focus was to look at both some surrounding areas. Here's the LTR plots here. You can see the little hectare plots. To begin to look out on the surrounding landscape. And we looked both at agricultural lands, which were managed by the farm and sampling different predators and processes, but we also identified some surrounding landscapes, deciduous forests, coniferous forests, and what were successional fields, which are now referred to as successional forests, because that's what happens with succession. Fields become forests. If you're wondering what this little cupcake is, this is part of the pond laboratory system, which is part of the Kellogg Biological Station as well. So what was the institutional impact? Well, there was some impact on other researchers because the LTR was now moving off of the 150 so acres it had taken away from the farm into the surrounding landscape. And they put in place a site use request form system where people, other researchers who weren't on the LTR, had to request permission to work in fields and forests because there was some concern about site integrity. Their work might impinge upon this long-term research. So there was a little bit of negotiating to make sure everyone understood the importance of that for both sets of researchers. 6 years later, the project continued, and we did an expansion to a new kind of experiment in the lower left-hand corner here. We set up a new experiment, which we call the biodiversity experimental plots. We had been saying for some time in our discussions this that our treatments allowed us to look at the role of diversity because we had some plots with cover crops, some without, et cetera. But there was no explicit manipulation of diversity in cropping systems, so we put that in, and we came up with about 20 different treatments, which are color-coded here in four replicates, and you see depicted here in the landscape. Importantly and different, these experiments had all of the entry points of the rotation present. The large-scale main site experiment has the same problem that some of the others are, where we have corn years, we have bean years, we have wheat years, and so only every 3 years can we make these comparisons. Now we could look at entry points and look at corn in every year, beans in every year. We could have continuous corn compared to corn in a very diverse planting system. We did not have any staggering, however, of the entry points. It also allowed us to make some linkages to other grassland studies, but looking at the role of diversity. Dave Tillman's work in Minnesota, but also several studies in Europe that had been looking at the relationship between diversity and ecosystem function, and we felt it was important to have an agricultural example of that. So an important institutional impact as we began to do this was to basically say that agricultural production systems could be used to address basic questions in ecology and could see what the similarities and differences were. Now, there are some intriguing results from this, which we published, which, in hearing the history of the Morrow process, maybe not such news to everyone, but looking at corn, soybeans, and wheat, we found that as we increase the diversity of the system, these are continuous monocultures to corn-bean rotations, to corn-bean-wheat, and then adding cover crops in various combinations, we got this very nice, and I see now expected, linear relationship between yield and in corn, but not in either wheat or beans. And in fact, conventional corn averages for the surrounding counties were less than what our most diverse mixtures are. Now, one might ask why it is that farmers in Michigan are so stupid that they continue to put fertilizer on the plots when all they would have to do would be to add this magical rotation. Keep in mind, wheat and soybeans didn't do so well. And these are also very small plots. And the question of scale is really important when we're trying to extend results from these long-term experiments to agricultural production systems, because farmers are farming much larger and heterogeneous pieces of landscape than we do as scientists. And that, in fact, was a very important consideration in the next renewal of the LTR, which we call the scale-up period. The main site plots, which are shown here, have been giving us some very interesting results, but again, are 1 hectare. So through some pretty serious negotiations, we convinced the farm manager that he needed to donate even more land to the LTR and to allow us to scale up some of these experimental treatments. In particular, treatment 1, which is conventional, treatment 3, which is low input, and treatment 4, which is the organic, and asked to see, do we see some of the same results on a larger landscape, more typical of what farmers will be doing, that we see in our plots. Particularly, we'd seen that treatment 3 tended to outproduce treatment 1 in some cases in some years. We wanted to know what and why. We also realized the importance of having all of the entry points. So we didn't have corn years and bean years and wheat years, so we had to have all 3 entry points. Field size we knew could be important, particularly for some biocontrol aspects. So we had 3 field sizes, small, medium, and large. And Sasha Kravchenko, who was new at Michigan State, helped with the design of that, and there were three replicates. So almost 300 acres was now committed, an additional 300 acres to this project. We also added some new co-PIs. Some of the original PIs and co-PIs had retired, and so we added a social scientist, Scott Swinton, a landscape ecologist, entomologist. We replaced Mike Klug with Tom Schmidt, who is a microbial ecologist, and brought another agronomist onto the project. So what's the institutional impact? Well, clearly this was important to do, because this would begin to broaden the relevance of the research here to something more typical for agriculture, but it's begun to really constrain farm management. An LTR agronomy committee determines what the protocols will be and what will be planted, and that's what he has to do. Manure deposition has become an important issue. We have a dairy, as you'll see, and where was he going to put the manure? And it was different kinds of crop management than he was doing, and he couldn't be responsive to pricing. He had to plant wheat no matter what, and soybeans despite the fact that all the deer were eating them, because that was a protocol, and it's had some pretty significant cash flow problems for him. Also, in the last 6 years, there's been some new opportunities which we have stepped up to, which was DOE put out a call for bioenergy research centers nationwide, and one of those centers was supposed to focus on sustainability, and we were able to put together a successful proposal with the University of Wisconsin and several other institutions to look at the sustainability of biofuel cropping systems, both current and future generations of biofuels. So it's a $125 million award, the largest Michigan State has gotten for 5 years, and Michigan State is the site nationally or the sustainability projects. Now, we did convince them that University of Wisconsin should also do that, so we'd have replication in two sites, but initially it was only funded to be at Michigan State. An additional 54 acres of cropland, again, some of the best, close to 20 treatments, and these plots are highly instrumented. Now, this has had some both good and bad institutional impact. It has certainly increased station and site visibility to have this project there, the magnitude of it, and the number of investigators. It's promoted linkages to other research and collaborators within the GLBRC, particularly at the University of Wisconsin. We've got much tighter collaborations. It has further decreased the flexibility of the farm manager. We've added new and more staff, but it's also increased the need for technology and connectivity, and the university has responded to that in part. While I'm here, a new fiber system is going in to allow us to be able to transmit data more quickly into more places. We also, in the last 2 years, have put in a new pasture-based dairy center. We've had an experimental dairy on site that was a conventional dairy in response to a host of social, political, ecological, and economic drivers. Have established a pasture-based system, which is on the same street, 40th Street, and right across the street from the LTER, which has made some interesting opportunities to compare pasture with cropping systems and biofuels. Institutionally, it's had positive impacts, again, visibility. Part of this is driven not so much because we've got cows on grass, lots of people do that, but we're milking our cows with robots. And this robotic milking system is very interesting for a lot of reasons. And almost everybody, including the Board of Trustees, like to come down to see KBS now. I don't think it's because they want to see cows. I know it's because they want to see this pasture management system. But it's again put an additional constraint on the farm. Now, our new proposal is due in February. We will have to write a 6-year proposal. We will have to address new and interesting questions, but show our commitment to the existing experiments. We're focusing and broadening the focus, in part driven by the need to have a better understanding of humans and human interactions, global change, and we're therefore strengthening our interactions with social scientists. The new theme will be something close to farming for services in a changing environment. But we haven't really decided entirely on that, so I'm not going to let you stare at that for too long. But the funding will be increased to close to $1 million a year. Now, that's a lot of money, but as I'll show you, this is a research project that has to support a lot of science and a lot of scientists. And so on a per-scientist basis, it's not that much. So let's talk a little bit about impacts. I am now in an administrative role, and we're all about impacts and metrics. How are you going to measure the impact of something that's taking such a substantial amount of the personnel and resources of an institution and ask if it was worth it and should it be continued? So common metrics in academia, we all know, it's scholarship. Who's publishing? What's being published? What's the impact? What grants are coming from this? What are the educational impacts? Are we training the next generation of scientists, and if so, how well? And what has been the success of outreach to a whole host of constituencies, producers, teachers, policymakers, and others? Well, I'd like to start off by saying, by whatever measure you use, a meter stick or a yardstick, I think I will be able to show to you, and hopefully to our deans in a couple of weeks, this has been a very successful and is a very worthwhile investment. Numbers of publications continue to increase from this project. We ask all scientists who either work on the project or use data from the project to let us know when they have published. And we're relying on self-reporting, so this is probably an underestimate. Now, I could say that I first fit a linear curve to this, and it was a pretty good fit, but let's just say that we don't expect publication rate to always increase. But we're now getting 40 to 50 papers per year published using data from the LTER project. And these are in a broad range of high impact and important journals to a broad range of disciplines. Increasingly, we're finding our papers are being published in those very highest profile journals like Science and Nature and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So the data are being published, and they're being published in some of the very best journals in a variety of disciplines. The publications include not just science, but policy data. I show here a graph depicted on the back of one of them. There was a paper published in Science in 2000 by Phil Robertson, Dick Harwood, and Elder Paul, where they talked about the global warming potential of different kinds of cropping systems. And using the treatments from the LTR showed that, in fact, conventional agriculture had a high global warming potential compared to no-till. And interestingly, the early successional plots, which Elder will have to admit he thought were a very bad idea to have in this experiment, showed this very interesting result that a negative global warming potential because of the ability to sequester carbon. That data and data like that have been very important as we begin to think about the shift from annual to perennial biofuels crops. How will we be able to show that? And we have data like this to be able to show that. As I've indicated along the way, the LTR is a well-funded project by the National Science Foundation. Over the time, the amount of money per year and the total amount of money has gone up in recognition of being asked to do more and the increasing cost of science. So we started with a grant of $400,000 a year, which is a lot, and this year's grant is $820,000 a year. So it's doubled in that time. Now, in direct costs, it hasn't quite doubled because, of course, the indirect cost rate has also gone up. But you're talking about a project that gets between about $280,000 and now is getting close to $550,000 a year. But this grant, about half of it goes to maintain the experiment itself, the management of the experiment. The other half is going into a disciplinary or specific science, and there are 7 co-PIs. So it's about $30,000 to $35,000 per year. It's not a huge amount of data per individual. It's the investment in the project that's valuable and the fact that the data are shared. The indirect cost to the university, however, is significant. So the first grant, we were generating about $116,000 per year in IDC. That matters to an institution. The current grant is generating about $270,000 a year in IDC return to the institution. This is something that was referred to this morning. There is cost return to us. As you'll see, there's cost sharing. But the value comes because we can demonstrate that you are not only investing in the institution, but as you'll see, other grants have come along as a consequence of that. Because the LTR is highly leveraged. The current grant has, over the 6-year period, close to $5 million in the total award, but supplements about $1.9 million to date. So $7 million in direct funding from NSF to this project for various ways over the 6-year period. On site right now, there are 37 grants for about $43 million. These are not just grants to Michigan State University, primarily there, but they're also grants to other institutions. But the leveraging to Michigan State University to say, we're investing about $200,000 a year, which is the cost return we're getting, on a grant that is generating $7 million in grants from NSF and $43 million in grants from other institutions. So it pays to make the investment. There are educational impacts as well. Graduate students and undergraduates, although there's not much money to directly support graduate students, there are opportunities for graduate students to get involved in unique science in a number of ways. There's research and travel grants provided, travel to other sites as well, and funds for workshops and synthesis activities that allow graduate students to travel to other LTR sites. And here are 3 of our graduate students on a project that took them out to Andrews. Here are 2 of our graduate students who organized and led a workshop at a national meeting. funds for undergraduate researchers made available through an REU program. We have 2 to 3 every year, as well as an RET. A number of these students come from underrepresented groups and go on to do senior and honors theses. So there is an investment in undergraduates through the REU program. Now, NSF projects do not have an explicit mandate to fund extension or outreach, but what has become increasingly important and part of the culture of NSF is to write about the broader impacts of the research. Why are these funds being used, and who is benefiting, and not just the science? There's been a strong emphasis on the LTR program, as I mentioned, on teachers and students, a K-12 program called Schoolyard Ecology. We've now had 3 larger NSF grants that have specifically looked at K-12 education, and right now have one that's a math science partnership. We're working with teachers in about 15 surrounding districts, and last week we had 91 math and science teachers at the biological station learning about the long-term ecological research and agriculture that is there. We have workshops and programs for extension educators. Here are some in a soil pit. And this last year, we've increased our outreach to policymakers, which wasn't a bad thing to be doing in a year when the state was considering no longer funding ag experiment stations, talking about the impact on global change that agriculture can and does have. We have a very strong commitment not only to sustainable agriculture, but what we call environmental literacy. Can people understand what they read in the New York Times, in the Lansing State Journal, and the Kalamazoo paper? There are challenges. Not this whole list of ones that we heard earlier, but there are challenges that I put under the context of keeping the balance. The growth and success of this project has resulted in an increasing commitment of land-based to agricultural research. That's not a bad thing at an ag experiment station, but it is limiting the kinds of research we can do. The percentage of the agricultural land base that is now committed to the LTR and Great Lakes Bioenergy project is about 50% of our total, which is reducing the flexibility not just for the farm manager, but for other agricultural projects. If you add in the pastures, 71% of our agricultural land base is committed to long-term ecological research experiments. So that's both a good thing, but it's also a constraint on future projects. The other is keeping the challenge. I'm at the Kellogg Biological Station, not the Kellogg Agricultural Station. And our mission includes not just sustainable agriculture, but basic research in ecology and evolutionary biology. And we have other faculty there. So the perception of the institution, Michigan State University, needs to be that it values not just these highly visible, large-scale, long-term agricultural projects, but the other work we do as well. KBS now has 13, soon to be 14 faculty there that are nationally known. They work in a range of fields. We've had long-term studies going on Gull Lake, for example, understanding the dynamics of that lake system. We have had a number of faculty who work on the evolution of flora morphology and the importance of pollinator services, not just because of the value to agriculture, but because it's an interesting evolutionary question. And we have a growing component of our faculty interested in theoretical ecology and computational biology. So keeping the balance administratively is so that the 3 or 4 of us that are highly engaged with sustainable agriculture work are not viewed as completely running the show, and letting the other 8 to 10 faculty realize this is a value to them is very important as an administrator. So in summary, from an administrative perspective, there are pluses and minuses to a long-term, large-scale, highly leveraged agricultural project like this. The success requires a strong institutional commitment, not just from the president and the provost and the deans, but from the faculty that are there and the other faculty that are at that place to see the value of this. It requires flexibility and cooperation among different people to see the value of partnerships and what they can be. AES and Extension have been very important and are increasingly important to that, particularly in terms of translating the science out into the applied communities. There are costs, but the net effect is positive. This is very high profile, high impact science. It's nationally and internationally recognized, and importantly, it's institutionally valued. At a time when the institution is talking about 20 to 22% budget cuts, it's important to be institutionally valued. So overall, I have to say, it is very good to be part of a national network of long-term ecological research stations and the only one focused on production agriculture. I can only hope that over the next decade or two, we will see more of those so that we will have collaborators who are specifically looking at row crop agriculture and not just grasslands and penguins. Thank you.
Have time for a few questions if we have any questions for Catherine.
There.
Hey, what's your, this is kind of an open-ended question, obviously, but what's your perspective on how the LTDR system will complement Neon and vice versa?
Well, I think there's two things. Some of the LTDR sites are part, so Neon is a national Earth observing network. It's another network. And there are 20 sites. Okay. Some of the LTDR sites are Neon core sites. So there's that complementarity as well. Some are not. So the Great Lakes one, where KBS is a site up in northern Wisconsin, a long, long way away. So Neon made an explicit decision to put their observing systems into unmanaged, native, minimally human-impacted systems. So that took production agriculture and a lot of things out. I understand the reason why that is, but it also misses a very important factor that working lands are a really important component of what we have nationally. And if we don't understand the connection between working lands and these pristine areas, we'll have missed an important thing. So the idea is that Neon wants the infrastructure of what will spread out. I think the kinds of things we heard this morning suggest that there will be a great opportunity to get funded to do research in these surrounding more working lands. Production agriculture is certainly one of those, and to be able to link up to these Neon systems. So that's where I see and hope the linkage will be.